This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark and we have a wonderful show for you today. We're going to crack straight on with some movie news with the smooth-talking criminal that is James Gill in the studio. We've got a lot to talk about, James, and not actually much time, so let's just go for it. What have you got for me?
Well, I thought we might kick off with Denis Villeneuve because Blade Runner 2049 is out now, and after we finish this chat, that is what I will be going to see.
Yeah.
So I know that...
I'm very excited, are you?
Super excited. Yeah. I actually think the first film, I don't want to say, you know what I'm going to say?
I know what you're going to say.
It's so overrated.
Yeah.
It looks amazing. Visually, it gets under your skin. It stays there. But as a movie, I really can take it or leave it.
I haven't seen it for about 20 years, so I'm going to watch it before I see the sequel. And I think I'll reserve judgment on whether it's overrated or not, because the clips I've seen, I always go, wow, how amazing is that? So as a story and as a piece of storytelling, I'll wait until I rewatch. Which one do you watch? Because there's so many cuts. That's the problem.
I think it was the 12th director's cut that I saw. it was the one that was back in cinemas a couple of years ago. So it wasn't.
Is it that, with or without voiceover? Because that was always one of the big things, wasn't it?
With?
Okay.
How many different versions have there been?
There's about five,
yeah,
I think.
I was going to say four or five.
Yeah.
That's bonkers, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay, so, yeah.
I want to see more versions of Happy Gilmore.
Five director's cuts, okay.
Yes. So the thing with Villeneuve, I know that I personally, when I started this on this show, I was like Captain Enthusiasm. Then I sort of like turned to the dark side.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel a little bit more hopeful because of people like Denis Villeneuve. This is, all right, I know he's making a sequel, but he's such an original and exciting talent, and he has such an aesthetic style. So the film where most people thought, oh, okay, this guy's got something, was probably Prisoners, the Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal movie.
Which I loved.
Which is just sensational.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. It's sort of a film that you could watch that again and again.
Yeah,
You know, it's just really beautifully made, dark as you like. And then he made Sicario, which I probably preferred Prisoners, to be honest with you, but that was a really big hit.
Mm-hmm.
I think Arrival is a classic, and I think in 20, 30 years' time, we will remember Arrival as a truly great movie. It's my favourite film of 2016. I loved it so hard. I actually felt that in doing a sequel, I thought, you know what, they're lucky to have Denis Villeneuve rather than the other way around. That's how good this guy is. I think Daniel Craig wants him to direct Bond.
Said the other day, apparently, that he would... where's he from?
Maybe it's French-Canadian.
Maybe it's a language thing, but he said doing a Bond would make him very, very happy. So that's definitely not someone going, no, I won't do a Bond.
Him doing a Bond would make us all very happy.
So good, wouldn't it?
Can you imagine? Chris Nolan, I think, will do a Bond one day.
He will, but he said that he wants to do it with the full reinvention.
That's right.
Meaning a new actor. He probably likes Craig, but he just wants to have that full autonomy over, like, everything. But
I'm going to say it now.
Go on.
Nolan will do it when Craig has left and... it will be Nolan's pal, Tom Hardy, as Bond. I just think the stars are aligning for that to happen.
Yeah, that's true. That could work.
If the deal with Sony...
Does that mean we won't be able to understand what James Bond is saying?
There'll be subtitles. we'll have to learn French to watch the dubbed version so we can understand what's going on.
What is it with Tom Hardy and always being...
It's... Is it like a running gag?
Gag. I don't get it. I don't understand why. Either he does he picks an accent that you really struggle to hear, or he's got some kind of mask or something over his mouth.
Maybe Bond wears a mask.
Yeah.
And does a Bane voice all the way through.
Yeah, maybe. But that would be
it. James Bond. James Bond.
That sounds more like John Merrick.
Yeah,
it wasn't.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that film. But I'd also like to see the... is it Dennis? Denny? I don't know.
I'm from Leeds. I'm going Dennis.
Yeah. Den.
Den, you got a nice visual eye. Yeah. Don't I mean Den?
Yeah. Den. Yeah, you put it out of bag, didn't you, mate? I would be very excited about Bonfire. But what do you think the chances are, being the expert that you are?
Super high.
Yeah? Why isn't it
the only worry is that Villeneuve selfishly wants to make Dune.
Yeah.
He's quite obsessed with Dune. So he doesn't want to do the Lynch version. He wants to do the source material.
Okay. Well, can I just say now, Den, if you're listening, big fan of your work. put Dune on hold.
You can make Dune anytime.
You can make Dune anytime. And people,
Dune's going nowhere.
Yeah. People want Craig's Last Bond to be really special, so go for it. What else have you got?
Rush Hour 4.
What?
Yes. Rush Hour 4.
Is this a franchise people are desperate for more of?
It's a franchise I'm desperate for more of.
Okay, well, that's all that matters.
So we were talking about comedies recently. I would say Rush Hour 1 and 2 are classics of the action comedy genre, which is a genre that's hard to get right. Rush Hour 3, let's just pretend that didn't happen. You know, Rush Hour 1 and 2, Chris Tucker negotiated such a clever deal that's the reason why Chris Tucker barely does anything, because he made such a sickening amount of cash from Rush Hour 2. He made like gajillions.
Is that really it?
Yeah. I think he got like a percentage.
No, but I mean, like, well, you don't know. Well, do you know Chris Tucker? Maybe has he done your gigs?
CT.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know CT.
CT at the ABC.
But obviously, a lot of actors have big hits.
But they still want to make stuff.
But if you check out Chris Tucker's back catalogue.
Well, I'm in off the top of my head. I can't think of a single film he's done since the Rush Hour films
went crazy. How cool is that? It's the equivalent of, you and your friends will have the conversation. What if you won the Euro Millions jackpot? Yeah. Would you? Chris Tucker has basically answered that question, and he said, I'm going to take it pretty easy. Thank you very much. Chris Tucker, I salute you, because you're sort of living the dream there.
Yeah.
Chris, we've got a film for you. You know what? I'm good.
Yeah, I'm alright, mate. I'm just chilling at the moment, actually. I'm just watching the Rush Hour franchise at home.
Literally. I like to think that Chris Tucker has a vault of cash and dives into it every morning, a la Scrooge McDuck. So Jackie Chan has said that he's up for it, but it's all on Chris Tucker. Let's make it happen.
I like the first one. I don't even know if I've seen the second
one. The second one is so good.
Is it? Okay, well, I'll check that out.
I love those movies. They've got a great vibe about them. The chemistry between the two is just perfect. Rush Hour 3, it's so weird that it's not a good movie.
Why do I have a weird thing about franchises that they should be trilogies and then end there? Why, when it's 4 or 5, I get... But then I suppose, you know, Bond is a franchise that just runs and runs. It doesn't have to be. But I guess if it's about the same...
To back up your point, Bond is essentially a separate story each time. All right, I know there's a bit of an overarching arc in some of them, but generally speaking, they're all separate movies where other trilogies have been made. For example, the Star Wars movies come out as trilogies because they have a...
They're almost like three acts.
They've like specially been designed to be three stories, haven't they?
I don't like the fact that they're making an Indiana Jones film again.
Whereas I think they need to do that.
What, to try and right the wrongs of...
100%.
Oh my God, that was... What? That was a travesty, that was.
It was just... jaw-droppingly bad.
Oh my! I'm sorry, because I love everyone involved. Those films were such a big part of my childhood.
I'd love to know. I would love to see the movie that Frank Darabont wrote and got told, "No, you're all right."
Yeah, because it was bound to be better than what they shot.
Unless Frank Darabont spat onto a piece of A4, I don't see how he could have been.
Let's shoot this.
There might be something in there.
Well, it sounds like he does spit on scripts.
Indeed.
Yeah.
He's an angry man. You know what?
That's probably why.
I sort of knew where he was coming from, though.
What you mean, are you talking about Walking Dead now?
Yeah, the guy had a vision. He wanted it to be a certain way. Yeah. He cares. He's passionate.
They fucked off his Indiana Jones script.
Yeah.
And then they kick him off a show he creates and showrunners. He's an angry man. He's got every right to be.
Shawshank Redemption is one of the greatest movies of all time. He doesn't get the credit he deserves for that. Frank Capra made It's a Wonderful Life. People adore Frank Capra.
Oh, he gets the credit for Shawshank.
I don't know.
He does.
Frank Darabont?
Yeah.
Frank Darabont should still be banging out movies.
But let's go back to Indiana Jones for a second.
Yes, I would love to.
I'm sorry.
Do you remember the sword fight? The CGI sword fight? What is going on?
No, but let's not bash the film too much. My issue is that he's playing a character who is all about running and punching and he's just not at that. Like,
I
get it if he's playing someone that can't quite do that but does it anyway, but not where that's the sole point of the character is that he's this adventurer. It just looks a bit...
Embarrassing. Because Craig's Bond could get away with it because there's like a running thread with Bond that he's a bit over the hill, but he's still able to pull it off.
Yeah.
Whereas Harrison, God bless him, you know how old he's going to be when the next film comes out?
I don't...
93.
No, he's not.
No, I'm joking.
I was totally there. I was like, oh my God. Because like in Star Wars, they just about got around the fact that when he runs, he looks like a doddery old man.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, Harrison. Like, I'm a big fan of yours, but
what's your
it happens
Ford
to everyone.
Movie? Listeners, shout out your answer.
I would go for outside of the franchises.
No, inside, pick whatever you like. I know what mine is. I'm writing it down now.
I mean, like, I was. I think I was always.
I reckon we've got the same one.
I don't know, you know. I think it's either in the franchises, it's got to be Indiana Jones, possibly the first, or the I like the third one.
Mate, this is why you and I get on so well. The third movie, I thought I'd lost you, boy. I mean,
we talked about this. We talked about this. But I love Witness.
Oh, that is why. I'm holding up a piece of paper. With
Frantic.
The word Witness.
Frantic, severely underrated movie.
Not seen since I was a child.
Polanski,
really?
Who, you know, there's issues there as well.
There are.
You know,
I mean, we're going to talk about Mr. White. Speaking of issues, because we've talked Polanski on here in the past. We've talked Woody Allen in the past, and obviously the Weinstein thing.
Yeah.
I mean, and again,
just to touch on that.
Yeah. Kudos to Rose McGowan and Ashley Judd as well.
He's apologising and suing.
Reportedly, yes.
So
he's like, oh, sorry guys, see you in court. Sorry guys, with his fingers crossed.
But it's a bit weird to do that, because if there's remorse and apologies, but he's saying some of what you said isn't true, it's like, that's pretty murky, isn't it?
And also, if it's going to go to court, surely that will only mean that more things come to light.
True.
I mean, it's awful, isn't it, that these things go on and have done for so long.
I know. But then, the problem is my head as a host is going, can we really delve into this subject with only a couple of minutes spare?
Well, tell you what,
I don't think we can. You can't do bullet points on something like this. It's just too big.
We'll do a really clunky one show style gear change. Do you see Mel Brooks talking on the one show about? Because they go from like something hilarious to something tragic.
Right.
So on a positive note, I've just been going through the, because this is the kind of guy I am. I was going through the box office takings for 2017. And I know that we've talked about this in the past, and it can be quite grim reading, the amount of sequels and remakes and reboots and spin-offs and what have you. However, three original, truly original movies have performed very, very well this year, and that's Baby Driver, Dunkirk, and Get Out.
Yeah.
And these have all been...
Big Sick as well. Maybe not quite as big as
those. I think you're absolutely right to include that. Yeah. And these are movies that are not just original in terms of they're not sequels, but actually they looked and felt original. Mm-hmm. I mean, Baby Driver, I mean, you don't see many movies like that ever, do you, really? Even if people who don't like it, at least Edgar Wright was trying something. Yeah. It's my favourite Edgar Wright film.
Is
since
it?
Shaun of the
Dead.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
I probably agree with you there.
And then also to tie it back to Denis Villeneuve, I just think that... studios are perhaps realising that we, the punter, actually want...
original,
movies,
different...
You know what? Movies that are movies, good.
Yeah.
Because some of the films, even Spider-Man Homecoming, which is a terrific film, but perhaps suggested a sequel, reboot, remake fatigue. Because while it did well, it didn't... It's I think it's like fifth or sixth on the list this year. Which, when you're talking about Spider-Man,
two years ago, that would have been number one.
They will be quite disappointed with that.
I 100% agree. I feel like there is a tiny bit of hope. Even the only problem is they're not making the same sort of money as the big tentpole movies. But the fact that they're making a lot of profit, if you take into account...
The profit margin on Get Out was eye-watering.
I think it's just like, please, studio bosses...
Take a punt.
Take more punts.
Yeah.
Believe, like, let's go back to the 60s when, you know, before Cimino destroyed a whole film studio with his flop. But, like, let's put a bit more trust into directors and original stories. Listen, mate, I'm so sorry that we have to wrap up a bit earlier today.
I love you. I love the show.
Come back and let's. I mean, yeah, I can't. I've got to wrap this up. We have a brilliant... we've got a brilliant guest today. The wonderful Matthew Holness.
Oh, can I quickly say?
Yeah. It's got to be quick.
Super quick. I interviewed Ricky Gervais. It's out on Monday.
Yeah.
Balance magazine. It's out in London.
Yeah.
There's big David Brent news in there.
Okay.
See it on Monday.
All right.
Balance magazine.
Can you say anything?
That's more than enough. Just trust me.
Okay. All right. So we got Matt Holness coming up. You'll know him from. This is crazy how much this show has had an effect on people that we're still talking about it, which I love. From Garth Marenghi, it's like 15 years old or something, and people still reference and love that show. I think he did Man to Man, Dean Lerner as well.
Supreme talent.
He's a supreme talent. He was brilliant. Live performer, but now he's writing and directing. He's got a feature film coming out soon. We're going to chat to him in a minute. This is his first choice of his two songs from movies. This is Cut My Hair by The Who. Why should I care? Got to move with the fashion of being outcast. I know I should fight, but my old man is really alright, and I'm still living at home, even though it won't last. Well, I guess Pete Townsend, because that is the demo, but The Who as well. That is the first choice of our two songs from our guest today, Matthew Holness. Hello, Matthew.
Hello there.
You specifically requested the Pete Townsend demo.
I did, yes. I actually prefer it.
Yeah.
But
do you prefer his voice to Daughtry?
Well, he actually sings it on the album. It's from Quadrophenia. He actually sings it on the album. But I think I just think the demo is absolutely brilliant. I think it
goes a little bit almost reggae in the middle there.
Yeah. In fact, there's a lot of the demos are very different from the actual album, particularly like the track that everyone knows, Can You See the Real Me? And that's kind of very slow and different on the demos.
Right.
But they came out in a big box set, and it was the demos are just brilliant.
So. You're a a big Who fan.
I am a big Who fan.
Who
yes.
fan?
Yes.
I've got to say, I've never fully got into the Who. I love a lot of those 70s era, the Zeppelins, and I even like the Doors, which I know some people hate because it's quite pretentious. So, you know,
I got into the Doors recently.
Poetry thing, you know, But the Who. Do you know what my issue with The Who is? Love the band.
Yeah.
I'm not so as into the...
Auto-destruction?
No, just the front man, like the...
Daltrey.
Yeah. I've never bought into his...
I know what you mean.
His thing, and I always think it's really Pete Townsend's band, and he's sort of there
You can kind of just look at Pete.
Yeah.
You can kind of just shift, you know.
Do you think there are
people... I know what you mean. I know Daltrey's not quite... You kind of don't think he's quite as powerful as he needs to be. But I kind of, I don't know, I just love him. Daltrey,
Do you, and you like, you didn't go and see the short-lived West End musical of Tommy?
Yeah. Yes, I did.
Did you?
I did, very long time ago, though. Yeah. But I've seen The Who a few times as well.
Oh. And they are still amazing, aren't they?
They are.
Did you just pick that because you like the song, or do you like the whole Quadrophenia thing?
I like the whole album. But I like that. That's my favourite song from it, and I like it because it's probably the most truthful kind of take on the teenage experience. I think it's completely warts and all. It's incredibly sad, incredibly angry, and there's just a million different emotions going on in that track. I think, and it's
this
great.
Is something you resonated with.
It does.
I did a little Wikipedia about you because you know that's the extent of my research with everyone.
Yep.
It says you were born in Whitstable.
I was. Yeah.
Did you grow up in Whitstable?
I did. Yeah. In fact, I wasn't born in Whitstable. I was born in Canterbury and I grew up in Whitstable.
So were you like the Tommy of Whitstable? Were you more like were you an angsty teenager in that
I think like any any teenager really.
My grandparents lived in Herne Bay just down the road.
For
5 or 6 years in the late 80s. Were you there then?
It was rough then.
It's not the place it is now, is it?
Well, Herne Bay is still not quite as refined as Whitstable has become. But
what's happened to Whitstable? Why
do you know what it was?
So
it was when Tipping the Velvet came out, and everyone suddenly went, "Oh, have you heard of Whitstable? It's this wonderful place on Tipping the Velvet." But apparently, all talking in speaking in Cornish accents. But anyway, it was overnight. Everyone flooded down to Whitstable, and the rest is Whitstable's history.
Is it like ridiculously expensive there now?
It is, and you used to be able to go for a walk on the beach, and it was actually quite nice because there was no one there. But you go down there for your nice, quiet, private walk on the beach, and there's about, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people doing exactly the same thing, all looking miserable because they can't find their little quiet moment.
Oh, man.
So,
it's eaten itself alive, hasn't it? Do you live in Norfolk?
I do, yeah.
So you've gone from a windswept town in Kent to...
to another one,
What's the choice for living in Norfolk?
I wasn't driving at the time, and my partner and I just decided to get on a train to visit a few places to see where we might want to live. And we liked where we ended up and thought, is it worth spending more on a train fare? No, so we just decided to move there.
Yeah. Okay, you based your entire future on one more travel card.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
There's a few other people from like the comedy world that live in that area, aren't there? Doesn't Adam Buxton?
Adam Buxton lives there. Yeah. Graham Linehan lives there, I believe.
Yeah.
But
you don't see these people on a...
I don't see anyone. No. Don't see anyone, mate.
Yeah. I'm always sort of weirdly envious of people that like have the courage to move out of London. Because there's always this thing hanging over your head that you'll like be out of some sort of loop if you don't live in London something.
Well, you kind of are. I suppose whenever you come back to do a day's work or something in London, just everyone asks you what's it like out there?
A passive aggressive way to start a conversation, isn't it? It's like, what are you thinking?
But no, I mean, it's fine. It's kind of, I am now motorway man. I do kind of sort of, the lonely businessman up and down the motorway stopping off at services.
Yeah.
But that's fine. I don't mind that.
Yeah. The reason I wanted to get you in specifically, I've always loved your work, but we share a friend, a colleague in James Harris, the producer, and he's obviously told me a few things about the film that you've just directed. And I'm so fascinated by... I don't know how well he pitched you know, like the elevator pitch, as they call it, the sort of one-liner.
What was his elevator pitch?
Well, I mean, he was saying it's about a man. This is if I may have got this wrong.
That's all right.
But something to do with a puppeteer.
Yeah.
Is he possessed?
No.
No, that's where I got wrong already. But he's...
Disgraced.
Disgraced.
Yeah.
That's it. Let me just put a bit of... Are you really hot?
It's a bit warm, actually. Yeah,
it's a bit hot, isn't it? Trying to get this room the right temperature is... Maybe it's just the chemistry we have. So why don't you do the elevator pitch for
Well,
this?
Okay. Well, I suppose it's probably important to say that it's not a funny film. It's okay. Not, you know, and people might think it might be because I've done like a spoof horror stuff before. And it's not. It's a serious horror film. It's about a puppeteer, a disgraced puppeteer, returns home with the intention of destroying his puppet. And it's sort of drawing on things. Like, this is not an elevator pitch, by the way. I've already gone way beyond an elevator pitch. So he comes home to sort of destroy the puppet that he thinks is the cause of all his problems. But the puppet won't kind of die. And the rest of the film is about him having to kind of deal with everything that the puppet throws at him.
And where does an idea like that come from?
I was asked to contribute to a book of short stories by Comma Press called The New Uncanny, in which they asked a load of writers to revisit and reinvent Freud's theories of the uncanny for a kind of modern audience. So I wrote it for that. It was a story called Possum, and then since then I decided, I thought it might make a good horror film.
Yeah.
So I sort of decided to expand it and...
It definitely has that. It feels, as you were describing it to me, it definitely feels like the makings of those kind of very culty, you know, Stephen King-esque horror films, rather than, you know, the blood and guts and that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's very little of that kind of stuff in this at all. It's more of a kind of psychological horror film, really. Mm. I mean, It's not pleasant.
Is it? You've screened it, haven't you? You've screened it.
No, we've not screened it yet. We screened a clip. We screened a clip, a 3-minute clip at, or 2-minute clip at Fright Fest.
Yeah,
and Norwich, the Norwich Crime Festival.
Norwich,
which is great.
Yeah, that is brilliant. Yeah. Do they struggle to get enough noir in Norwich?
No, not at all. In fact, a couple of years back, I went and saw Lee Child. Doing a talk in Gerald's department store in Norwich.
Amazing.
And so they get all the big names. Yeah.
I wonder what he thought of Norwich.
I think, well, because he's written a book, one of his books is set in Norfolk, and it's quite funny watching a crime audience, because they're actually so unforgiving. They didn't really care it was Lee Child there. They just sort of laid into him and said, you've got all the locations here completely wrong. And he sort of said, you've got to try and understand, I'm writing largely for an American audience. And they've got an idea of what Norwich and Norfolk is like, and that's what I'm writing for. So they were all kind
Lee
of...
Lee Child is the Jack Reacher guy.
Yeah.
I love that Norwich, you know, even though people don't bring culture to Norwich, or like bring tons of things to Norwich all the time, when someone sets something that could be read across the world, rather than be grateful, they're nitpicking about the detail of names of streets.
That's readers
and things.
For you. Yeah. That is readers. That's particularly genre readers. You know, they're very kind of you know, demanding.
I guess I get that. You got Sean Harris. I guess before this interview, I was assuming it was going to be at least in part comedic, your film.
Yeah, it's not at all. There's not one light moment.
Isn't there? And how did that feel compared to... Because you're obviously known mostly for comedy.
Mm.
How did that feel coming onto set and directing, you know, a proper actor as well?
Challenging, absolutely challenging, but it's something, it's not, I mean, I haven't, wasn't the first time I've done anything sort of completely serious. I did a drama for Sky Arts called The Snipist, which was similarly bleak and dark, and not remotely kind of comedic. To be honest, I mean, that's the stuff I would rather be doing. That's what I'm sort of concentrating on. I don't really do a great deal of comedy anymore, but it's quite a hard transition. You know, because as you say, people expect you to kind of be doing something a bit, you know, more lighthearted. So, yeah, that's kind of...
How are you finding, like, what do you feel like you have to do? Because I've
come on here and basically tell people.
Tell people, yeah. Like, just, you know, broadcast it to the world. Yeah. I suppose that is what you have to do, isn't it? I mean, I've done a few things where I'm like switching to slightly different genres, but nothing really extreme. It's not like going from, you know, Mrs. Brown's Boys to, you know, Ken Loach or something. But even when you just switch it or change what you're doing a bit, there is a, you do sort of get a confused reaction from people, don't you?
Absolutely. In fact, I remember seeing the first time we screened The Snipist. I mean, people just started laughing at it straight away. I mean, very quickly they realised it wasn't meant to be funny.
Was that a tense experience?
Well, it was, because I wondered, is it just bad? And they are laughing because it's so atrocious. But
you hadn't pre-prepared the idea that they would be looking at it. I suppose in a way, if you presented people with, say, a drama and said, this is a comedy, there must be a percentage of time in the first, like, 5-10 minutes where people are maybe laughing, thinking they're meant to be...
Yeah.
Until you go, hang on, this just isn't...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's...
It was when we started shooting dogs, they realised it wasn't funny.
So, oh. Yeah. But that could be funny?
Could be funny, could not the way we funny. Shot them.
There was that weird... No, well, how bad is it?
Well, military lining them up and putting them down without... Yeah.
This is in The Snipist.
That's The Snipist, yeah. So,
yeah, but not Possum.
No.
So what's happening with Possum? Do you have distribution dates?
Ask James. That's out of my hands, to be perfectly honest. It's finished. It's ready. So we're just waiting for... Yeah.
How do you get some... Okay, so you've got... Not only is it already hard to get British independent films made, but you're also trying to go against brand.
Mm. Mm.
How difficult was it from...
Well, it was very difficult because up until James came on the scene, basically, and I'll move on to that in a second, but it was difficult in that I did this other short. The first short I did was Gun for George, which was actually a mixture of tones. It was, you know, half comedic, half serious.
Yeah.
Comedic, is that comic or comedic? I don't know. I hope I'm not using the wrong, you know, sort of US terminology there. But that was quite a tricky...
If someone could tweet us and let us know. That'd be good.
Yeah. So that was actually quite hard, because when it came to writing like the feature length version, I was still trying to juggle the kind of humorous tone and the kind of the tragicomic tone, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's, which is a lot easier to do in a 17-minute short, because you can, the kind of sudden shift in tone works. But actually trying to do that in a 90-minute film, I could never quite get the point where it would, you know, suddenly become quite a serious film. And the trouble is, the audience are kind of invested in a certain type of film. And I think at that point, if you tell them it's suddenly, you know, oh, it's actually a tragic story, then I think they feel shortchanged. And it's kind of never really worked as a script. So that was quite problematic, because then it was, do I make it a comedy or do I make it a fully serious film? And I never quite could decide either way. So in the end, that project got kind of parked for, you know, temporarily. But that is the kind of that's the slight problem I have, in that people expect funny stuff, and
Do you think there are any films that do that where the tone can or change completely at some point later on in? I always feel like I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but I feel like there's been times where I'm like going, hang on, this isn't what I bought into, you know.
Well, I think it's. The more subtly done, the better it is. I think something like With Nell and I, which is hugely funny, but then has a very, very different kind of, you know, bittersweet sort of ending, and I think that handles that transition really well.
Yeah, I think because it feels quite tragic, even in its comedy.
Yeah,
you're not too surprised, but actually, it is quite a down ending, isn't it?
I think that's it. If the story is about something that's inherently tragic, failure of one kind or another, you know, then I think it's, you know, that's, you're halfway there anyway. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it's something that, you know, I couldn't quite get right at the time. Hopefully,
but
you know, we'll do.
Presumably you did at some point, and because you got to make the film and someone gave you money to...
Well, this, in terms of Possum, yes. Yeah. So James, I mean, basically wrote the script and actually was something that I thought no one would ever make, because it's just so unpleasant. And... But James sort of read it and got in touch and said, I love this. It's so horrible." and I was really surprised that there was actually interest in it quite quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was expecting it to be kind of, thanks. We, you know, just, can we not ask Matt for anything else?
Can you tell him not to come to London, please, anymore? Yeah. You shot it in Norfolk, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So...
Half in Norfolk, half in Three Mills Studio, London.
Was that just for ease, or was it set in...
It was set there. It wasn't actually set anywhere specific. Actually, I tell a lie, it wasn't set anywhere specific, but having been up there and written it round there, I was kind of... essentially basing it on that kind of area. So we ended up, and we kind of figured it would be quite a good place to set it. And I sort of went, oh, that's good. I can go home every night, not have to, stay away. So,
I love that British countryside has now become this kind of, for Americans, they must be so confused, because on the one hand, they go, oh, it's so twee and lovely, like in Four Weddings and a Funeral. And then on the other hand, it's like... Straw Dogs, or it's either, or with Nell and I, it's either this really grim, wet, dark, horrible place, or incredibly beautiful, full of rich people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of
you're contributing to the darker side,
the kitchen sink side. Yeah, that kind of side. Yeah, absolutely.
So you say you want to do more of this kind of thing, which. I hope you get to do, and but does that mean you're sort of completely shutting the door on comedic,
stuff? Not completely. I was in Back, which I thought was fantastic. So funny.
Yeah, I watched the first episode last night because I've been away, so I haven't, just catching up on it, and there was some bits in it I was really laughing at.
It's amazing. The scripts were so kind of brilliant. They just had me laughing out loud when I read them. So that was, I was really pleased to be involved with that.
And playing someone
dead.
Dead.
Yeah.
And a lot older than you actually are in some parts.
Yes. Yeah.
Vocally, did you, because there was in the one episode I've seen, there's that whole thing around the voicemail, answer machine thing.
Yeah.
Did you have to do some vocal work to sound older in that, or did you just...
I don't know. I know we recorded it a few times. We recorded it on location, then we did it again in the studio. So I don't know which version I got really wrong.
And these are... this is the first time... Is this the first time you've worked with Robert and David in a while?
In a while, yeah. In fact, the first thing I ever did was with Robert and David. That was Bruiser.
Bruiser, yeah. This is pre-BBC Three days. So it was on
back in... In fact, I think it was BBC Two, I think. I mean, it was... Well, when was it? 1999, I think. But I literally haven't worked with Robert and David since then. So, it was really nice to sort of work with them again.
And you actually did your scenes with them, didn't you? They sort of change age in those flashbacks and stuff.
It's quite weird, because it was just literally I would step on, say a line, then step off, and then that was it. So it was kind of it was a really enjoyable and it was just, it was a nice experience.
Just hit your mark, say the line.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Would you, if they do a second one, would they keep with the?
I have no idea.
With that theme of it. I'm not sure where it's going in terms of the story of the brothers and
I think Simon's planned it all. I think it's definitely, it's been worked out as far as I know. But
it feels bizarrely grown up for Channel 4 as well.
It does, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It
does.
It kind of feels almost... not traditional, but it's like a traditional in the sense that it's extremely well structured, extremely well written, and extremely well performed by Rob and David and all the other members of the cast. And I think that, it's kind of something that, I don't know, you kind of feel that there aren't that many, or it doesn't, it feels new to me, because it's kind of like, comedy for people that are older, and we used to sort of being told, no, we're not interested in you guys anymore, because you're getting on a bit now. So, it's kind of...
There's hope for us, yeah.
Yeah.
So you won't be writing... You're not pitching new comedy stuff for TV?
I've actually pitched... Well, I'm very happy with it, which is another kind of horror parody script. But it has literally been turned down by every single broadcaster in the UK.
Yeah.
So...
God.
So...
Yes, I know that feeling. Yeah. I know it.
So,
What is it about horror that comedy people love so much? Why is there a connection there?
I don't know. I wonder if it's something to do with... I wonder if it's something to do with the structure of the writing. And I mean, like structuring a joke works on certain rules. There's a formula to it. And I think it's a similar thing with writing something frightening. There's certain beats you need to
The build up and the payoff and
all
and
if
that
it's
kind
too
of
much, you know, if you know you can, you know, when you've like really pushed a joke the wrong way and you have to come, and I think it's the same thing, there's that immediate sort of response as well of, you know, the audience will be very unforgiving if they think it's not funny, that you'll know about it, and if they're not frightened or it looks stupid, they'll really know about it.
So if you can't hear a reaction, then it's a genre you're not interested in, I think.
Exactly.
I don't like just waiting for the applause at the very end. I need to hear I need to hear validation throughout the thing. I've found it's a weird. People say that horror comedy, anyway, is a really difficult thing to get right. But actually, in this country, in an industry where we're still massively dragging behind as a British film industry, it seems to be the one thing that certainly the indies do pretty well.
Yeah,
still.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of like B-movie, cult movie influence as well. I think that one of the last times we've interacted briefly was at Noel Fielding did a charity show at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yes, yeah.
And you did a bit there, but I don't recall you doing really much live stuff.
No, in fact, the last gig I ever did was at Boosh Fest, which was, 2008 now? God. I think that was when it was. I literally
That's scary that it's
yeah,
that long
I've not
ago.
Done any performing since then.
Yeah.
So.
Did you ever enjoy it?
No.
Ever?
Not really.
Not even Edinburgh when, you know, you guys were doing so well at the, you know.
Not really.
There wasn't a sense of, we've cracked Edinburgh.
No, not really. In fact, we were all quite relieved to sort of get out of Edinburgh, to be perfectly honest. In fact, I can remember us just holding on for dear life and sort of saying, look, we just have to get through the end of this run and then we can kind of go and not worry about coming back, which sounds incredibly awful, and you know, but it is true. I think that if you actually ask comedians their experience of Edinburgh, it's not a pleasant time. No. The worst comes out in everyone in Edinburgh.
Oh,
the egos go flying,
and also
paranoia.
In what other circumstance are you so directly pitted against so many other people? And as much as you could go in going, it's a festival, it's not a competition, try telling that to the inner critic.
Exactly. And know. It's hugely expensive for everyone as well. You know, you're going up there and you're losing, you know, a small fortune.
I guess the reason I'm surprised just saying that is, I'm on the one hand, I'm not surprised because I think any person with any self-awareness or sort of ability to go into a bit of an inward looking part of their brain, you have to be so like either zen or so massively confident to not be affected by that experience.
Yeah.
So if you've even got a slight bit of it, I get, like, I think most 90% of people struggle up there, but from afar, because I didn't really know you at that time, but from afar it looked like you guys arrived so fully formed, like your show seems so, you know, a lot of people take a few years to find their voice and get their thing, but you guys just landed and it was like, here's our thing. It felt really, not polished as in like slick, but just like you knew exactly what you were doing. And
well, I think we'd worked on it a long time. We'd sort of worked on the character and that, all that side of it. And I think we'd even written a small little tiny 5-minute radio thing or something. We kind of knew the characters very well.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was partly down to we had Paul King was our kind of director for the stage, and he was just very, very good, and you know, we were just well drilled, I think, you know what I mean. So
you'd been doing Garth Marenghi for a while, had you?
Not live, really. We'd sort of done the odd thing. We started off doing some stuff at Noel and Julian's comedy night at the Hen and Chickens.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we kind of did little bits that ended up in the stage shows, but we all had done, you know, all of us had done Edinburgh shows, you know, in various forms, so we'd kind of done it a few times before kind of going up with that show.
Do you find it surprising, because I definitely feel like the TV version I'm talking about of Garth Marenghi, still, even though it must be 15 years,
I reckon it's 13, I think 13. Actually 13, I think, is it? It was 2003, 2004.
So 14?
Sort of stuff.
Something like that.
I know, we're very bad at maths, aren't we?
Yeah. Let's not do a maths podcast, that's for sure.
That's
be awful.
It's 13. I've just worked it out. It could be 14.
Depending what time
Depending
you're
on when
running.
We started.
But considering it was that long ago, it surprises me how much the show still gets referenced. Yeah, not as in, you know, not because of the quality of the work, but like it feels like, wow, people obviously loved that show.
Mm.
And for any show that does one season and isn't like a crossover massive hit,
yeah,
when it's got that sort of loyal fan base, do people still talk to you about it?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, yeah. They do. And it's, you know, and it's nice to know that it kind of, I suppose,
what resonated, right?
Yeah, what's gratifying is I always like shows that meant a lot to me, and you know, and I think if our show means something to someone else, and they, you know, that's lovely, that's kind of perfect, that's, you know, that was the aim, I think.
How did you feel about it at the time when it went out, and were you...
Oh, God, I can't really remember. It was... I can't honestly remember. It was a bit strange, I think.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it was pretty cool. It was... Well, maybe it wasn't, actually. 2003, it felt like you did the Edinburgh thing, and then you went into that, and all a bit of a whirlwind. Then I feel like you got quite a few parts where you were a variation of, you know...
Yeah.
Was that a beef of yours?
Well, it kind of still is, because most of the parts that come, you know... that I get offered are effectively, well, they used to be kind of like, you know, similar kind of computer nerds, and now they're kind of computer nerds but a bit more sinister and older, so they're invariably balding, fat, middle-aged men.
What's worse, a young enthusiastic computer nerd, or
they're all awful? That's why I just turned them down.
Yeah. Yeah. And are they often, does it actually say in the part, the description, computer?
Yeah, and that's the depressing thing. God. Well, the depressing is just reading the description. I always go to the description first, and, you know, it's invariably soul-destroying, so.
You don't really turn down parts just because of that, do you?
Oh, I do. I don't really do much. That's it. I don't really do much. I've never been interested in kind of just doing it for the sake of, you know, being in a show or on, you know. And that might sound a bit kind of pompous, but it is true. I've got no real interest to just... I'm not desperate to kind of be...
Well, I know why, because you're not paying London rent.
Well, there you
That's
go.
That's why. You can afford to not be picky. I like that. I was... directing a pilot that you came in and
that's right, yeah
and you
good.
Were brilliant. You were brilliant in it.
Thank you. You didn't cast me.
No, we didn't. No. But you know why? And hopefully you'll be flattered by this. You just didn't look old enough.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. That's very nice.
Yeah, but you were brilliant. We thought you did amazing. And that was like good. As an ex-stuntman, so that definitely wasn't computer techie guy.
Yeah, no, that's true. That was
fun. So you're obviously waiting to hear if you get distribution. I'm presuming you will. It sounds you've got good people in.
Yeah,
in the
James Harris is incredible, and you know he's
a doer.
Isn't he a doer, and I think that was what he just has this knack of making you feel like it's going to happen. You know, the film will happen. It was never that feeling of, well, it might not. It was just it'll happen. You know, so we're going to do this. So he's just got a great kind of attitude that just gives you confidence, and
it's almost a bit like, no, don't worry.
Yeah.
You're a bit like, how can you be so calm?
Yeah.
Sean Harris is in it. What are there other people that we would know?
Alan Armstrong.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
Alan Armstrong.
What, two brilliant character actors, proper like characters. I find Sean a bit scary, and I've never met him, but I just imagine he's got a real. He's got such a presence, isn't he? Maybe it's because he always plays, you know, psychopaths.
Well, he is, and he's a method actor. So, you know, when he's on set, he's in character. And, you know, if you've written an incredibly depressing horror film and you've cast him in it, then you're going to have that, you know,
that
as
guy.
The environment that you're filming in. And that's all the way, you know, that's how he does it. So,
For aspiring directors who might work with method actors, how do you approach someone who is in character between takes?
Well, I kind of feel that I haven't mastered that yet. So, you know, I don't think I have advice at the moment. In that it's tough, but it's I think you've just got to kind of respect the actor's space, really.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing worse than kind of being quizzed, you know, what do you want for lunch, when you're just, you know, going into some intense
part of your brain.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of allowing the actor the space and just having time and talking it through. I think, you know, Sean and I did a lot of, you know, we discussed the script loads before we even went into kind of filming. So it's just, you know, that's the way he works, and you know, and he's, you know, he's done great. So.
And then he went from The Orphaning to Mission Impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
Six or whichever one it is.
Yeah.
That must be weird going from that to that.
Yeah.
I often hear, like, from sort of very established movie directors. And I never know whether this is a cop out or not, but I think it's mostly true that they say, you know, most of the work directing an actor is the casting. If you give it to the right person, that's like 70% of the job done.
I think so, and knowing that, then being able to, if you're the writer and the director of the same thing, then kind of tweaking that script with the actor to varying degrees, which we did, you know. And, you know, some of Sean's input on the script was great because, you know, there were certain speeches and things like that. We just needed to kind of, you know, shift a little bit to kind of... it's a really important part of that process, I think.
Do you enjoy that bit, or are you more a technical guy? Or?
Well, I am kind of mixture. I'm more on the technical side, particularly with it being a horror film, because for me it was wanting to ensure that, you know, you can't really make a horror film without being technical, I think.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not one of those sort of writers that when the script's done, that's it. It has to be that. You know, you cannot change a line. You miss this. So not at all. I'm very flexible in that sense. You know, I like the flexibility of being able to change things, tweaking them, getting them right, you know, because that, so much changes when you're on set anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and some things don't happen because you literally can't get into the location you were thinking you were going to, you know, we didn't even have some of the locations halfway through filming. So it was kind of, you know, you just have to kind of adapt to whatever problems arise.
Yeah. Did you, watch the when you did a preview of the movie at Fright Fest? Were you there when it was screened?
I was, yeah.
How did that go down?
It seemed to go down well. There was one woman who screamed out, "Turn your effing phone off, you see," which was quite funny. But apparently I was told she does that every year. That kind of ruined the mood a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it was, I hope it wasn't my phone.
Is it, does it have moments that are like scare, you know, like, jump and
yes,
thrill
it does. Yeah,
yeah, okay. Because from my limited experience of Fright Fest, which I think includes two films, I love that the audience gets so involved in the. Yeah. They really like, they applaud when something horrible happens.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's like a very different experience to watching a horror film on your own or in a regular film.
And I think, you know, there's kind of horror films that, you know, that's great for, you know, for that, there's nothing wrong with that, I think. I mean, the clip we showed from Possum, it wasn't a jump moment. It was more, you know, it was kind of an eerie.
Yeah.
Eerie
I was gonna
moment.
Say eerie.
Eerie.
Yeah.
But you know, they were, you know, it seemed to go down very well there, so.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, I honestly cannot wait. I love it it's when I hear an idea that feels unexpected and fresh, and so massive good luck with that.
Thank you.
Now, before you go, you're going to talk to us about why you've picked this particular guilty pleasure, which sometimes it's not always a guilty pleasure. People pick things that I think maybe even they're just surprised they enjoy or something.
Yeah.
Would you say this is a guilty pleasure, or do you think it's something that is underrated or misunderstood?
I think it's a mixture too. I never regarded it as a guilty pleasure until the more I told people that I liked it, sort of gave me funny looks.
Okay.
So
what have you picked?
Well, when I spoke to you, I even got the title wrong. I said Everyone Loves Raymond, but I think it's Everybody
it's
Loves
everybody
Raymond.
Everybody loves
and this
Raymond.
Is it, you see. I'm not a huge fan of it enough to sort of know any... I don't even know the cast names particularly, or even some of the character names, but it is something that I think is a brilliant show, often for the wrong reasons.
Right.
And I suppose I mean by that, it's obviously a comedy of truth, you know, we all recognise dysfunctional family moments, all that kind of stuff, so that always makes me laugh, often despite myself.
Yeah.
But also I quite like the fact that often they will just push it far too far overboard, and you kind of go, it's now stepped into really bad territory. they don't really care, and I quite like that. I quite like it when they kind of really go for the, you know, because they're also always going for the studio audience.
Is it on like on Channel 4 in the mornings?
It's
or
on
one of
every
those,
morning on Channel 4, and it is, for me, it is blessed relief from the hell of news.
Yeah.
And I just like having it on just to kind of escape from all the horrible
people
rubbish.
Are hard on the studio sitcom. They're really hard on it, and
You know, that it is an art form of itself.
Well, I am usually hard on it because I usually hate them. I can't stand studio sitcoms.
Really?
But that one I like. Because
even the classics?
Yeah, they just don't really do much for me, to be honest. No.
And yet the one studio sitcom you seem to that gets you is
I like it because it's
Raymond.
Ticking all the studio sitcom boxes so brazenly that I kind of find it really... Yeah. I sort of have respect for them really just going for it.
What about Seinfeld? Because that's a show people...
I love Seinfeld. Yeah. That's my favourite comedy.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I
so yes, that is a studio sitcom.
It is,
but yes, it is.
But maybe you're so into it that you can't even hear the audience laughing.
But also, they kind of just jump out. There's so much location stuff on that. It never feels like it's a studio sitcom. Yeah. Seinfeld. Yeah.
I'm always amazed how if I see an episode of Friends, which seems to be, I'm sure if someone did research, there is an episode of Friends on around the world at any time. There must be.
Yeah.
Which then makes you think, how much money must these fuckers be earning? But I'm always amazed at how I'll, if I flick past it, I'll stop, kind of maybe a bit like, this again.
Yeah.
And then I've watched it to the end. You know,
this is it. They're just, you kind of just, you just sort of sit and you're
into it. They suck you in. There's something so warm and safe about them, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, as you say, in these times of trouble.
Yeah.
Only today I put my news app on and read three headlines and wanted to be sick.
That's it. It's too depressing, you know.
So your contribution to this world of depressing news is a really
just
dark...
to do a really depressing, dark film. That's,
I appreciate it. Thank you. to finish off today, you're going to give us another song. Well, actually, you didn't know that when we asked you for songs, we were like, can you pick... you just gave us... just a favourite song of yours, right?
You wanted a song that was in a film, and I gave you a song that I had no idea was in a film, but turned out to be in a film, luckily.
Yeah, Best Friend by the Beat. But that's and then when we were in the studio, you were like, oh, well, if it has to be a film, you would have picked Ennio Morricone's, what is this, Milano Odia?
Which is a horrific film, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend to people, it's got a lot of problems with it. Thematically and you know, lots of things that are not great, but it's an Italian crime film which the translation is Almost Human. I think it's an Umberto Lenzi film, but the music is by Ennio Morricone and it's absolutely fantastic. It's a really great score.
Is this piece of music really depressing? Should I I pick the beat or this? Do you think?
Well, let's go for the Ennio Morricone. It's very similar actually to the music that he composed for the recent Quentin Tarantino from the Hateful Eight. It's quite similar, I think.
And is this from 60s era?
70s. I think it's like a 74, 75, 76 film, I think.
Yeah. You're really pinning it down to a specific time there. It's anywhere between 61 and 69.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's an ultra violent film. And
is it?
Yeah, and it's incredibly misogynistic. It's not really a film that whole genre I don't think will ever kind of be fully embraced because of that. But
this is totally going off on a tirade, but did you hear all that stuff that came out about what was the Marlon Brando film, Last Tango in...
Yeah, awful, shocking.
All the stuff about how they deliberately... Mm. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
There's so many things that happen where you find out the filmmaker or someone's, a bit of a wrong'un.
Yeah.
And you have that moral dilemma how much you love their films, but...
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think, it's very hard to disassociate it, I think. Quite rightly, I think.
So we should disassociate any Morricone.
The music is what's great here. It's a really great score. So.
I am intrigued to see this film now, though. I'll let you know whether it offended me. I'm sure it won't. Matthew, how do you like to be?
No. Either's fine.
Because I've always known you as Matt.
That's fine then.
Well, as in Matt it is. Oh, Matt.
Are you Dan or Daniel?
I'm born Daniel, grew up Daniel, ended up Dan. Don't like it though. Feels too like a bloke.
So I call you Daniel?
Call me Daniel. You'll be the only person.
Daniel, thank you.
Matthew. It's been my pleasure.